Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Therapists' offices are supposed to be places where you can be both vulnerable and safe. But what happens when your therapist crosses a line? Well, that happened to Juliana Baggett, and she writes about it in her essay, Playing Role Reversal with My Therapist. It's read by Oscar-nominated actress Isabelle Huppert. She stars in the new film Greta in theaters now.
Before my husband quit his job and his top-notch insurance ran out, he and I got checkups and dentist appointments. We got new glasses and signed up for a few therapy sessions. My therapist was awful. I talked about my occasional panic attacks and insomnia, and she gave me homework, rating my anxiety on a scale of 1 to 10 in a notebook, a process, it turned out, that made me more anxious. My husband's therapist, on the other hand, had him talking about his childhood and his recurring dreams about breathing underwater and not being able to find his soccer cleats. His homework was to write a long, angry letter to his mother that he didn't ever have to send. Eventually, our insurance ended. We wrapped up therapy and went on with our lives. A few years later, however, I hit a mental wall and was willing to pay out of pocket for good therapy. I asked Dave if I could go to the guy he had seen during our top-notch insurance glory days. I saw the difference immediately. Dave's therapist was fantastic. He was older than I was, but not so old that I would have to waste time explaining a Marky Mark reference. He had read my novels and poetry collection when Dave was his patient, and right from the start, he was able to make groundbreaking connections between my writing and my life. He asked me pointed questions about my childhood, and I cried. He took lots of notes. One night, lying in bed with Dave and talking about a recent therapy session, I said, "Wouldn't it be easier if he let me read all of the notes he takes while I yammer?" Dave looked at me quizzically. "He takes notes? He never took notes with me." "Maybe you were a textbook case," I told him, "and notes weren't necessary." Dave accused me of psychological arrogance, and he was right. Having come from a stable home with loving parents, I had never felt entitled to anything more than second-class neurotic status. Now I was proud that my apparently complicated psyche was being taken seriously. When I confessed during a session that I wanted to be of more use, my therapist told me to read Marge Pierce's poem, To Be of Use. When I complained about critics, he showed me a poem by Frank O'Hara, in which the poet compares critics to assassins. And then, at the end of one session, he handed me a piece of folded paper and told me to read it later. I assumed it was another literary pick-me-up. I read it in my car. It was a poem. A handwritten poem. One he had written about me. For me. Worse, this was no first draft. It was well-crafted and made literary references to my work. The poem included a divining rod, blue butterflies, and a fairly lush description of my lips. There seemed no way around it. This was a love poem. I drove home and gave it to Dave. I told him who had written it. Dave looked up at me, alarmed. This is a bad sign in a therapist, isn't it? I nodded. My first reaction? I thought it was interesting. Being in therapy, I thought about things in terms of whether they were interesting. This clearly was. My second reaction was self-pity. He was a great therapist, minus the fact that he had written me a love poem. And I had been making progress until now. I complained today that I didn't want to go back to my old therapist and take up grading my anxiety in a notebook. And I didn't want a new therapist to whom I would have to rehash my childhood. My third reaction settled in over the course of the next few days, and it had to do with the adrenaline rush of catching an authority figure doing something wrong, having proof of that misdeed, and knowing the balance of power was about to shift in your favor. What would it mean to have power over my therapist? How would I wield it? Furthermore, wasn't there something fundamentally, psychologically wrong with wanting to wield power over one's therapist? Wasn't this something one should discuss with a therapist? I confided in one of my girlfriends who had run through a lot of therapists on her own while playing badminton. Badminton with cocktails was maybe the best therapy for both of us. "Call him up and break things off on the phone," she said. "They're used to it. People do it all the time. It's my preferred way of breaking up with a therapist." She was in therapy for conflict evasion, among other things. "Are you kidding?" I said. "Of course I'm going back, if for no other reason than to see the look on his face." But even as I said this, I was anxious. I thought I had known him, but the poem was such a shock that now all bets were off. What was I walking into? Was the poem a test of some sort? Was it interesting in a way that I wasn't getting? Did the poem mean something that, if I read it correctly, would lead to a breakthrough? Before I left for my next session, Dave actually expressed concern and asked if he should come along, but I told him I wanted to go alone. "I think he's just a little vain," I said. "He overestimated the effect of his poetry." Basically, I led the session that day. We sat in our normal places, but this little hierarchy, me on the sofa, him in the leather chair, seemed all wrong. I said, "Maybe I should sit in the leather chair this time. Would you like to?" Things were different between us. The air in his little office was agitated. I asked him if he had a therapist. He did. I suggested they discuss the poem and his decision to give it to me. "Okay," he said, uncertainly. "Did you tell your wife about the poem?" He hadn't. I told him he should reflect on this. I asked him if he had taken poetry classes. For a short time, yes, he had taken graduate courses in creative writing. "Interesting," I said. Finally, I leveled with him. I told him he had written what I took to be a love poem, and in doing so, had stepped over the line. He defended himself, saying the poem was an attempt to make me more emotionally committed to my therapy. "I want to get you into therapy, not into bed." "I tell you everything," I said. "I answer any question you ask me. I cry every session. I'm a model patient." He claimed I wasn't really invested. I told him he was too invested. At that point, he admitted the poem maybe wasn't the best approach, but he said it was a sincere, creative attempt to make me engage. But it was carefully written in his own hand. He had slipped it to me to be read later. And what about the line about my lips? When my time was up, I asked to look over the notes he had taken on me. I asked this as I was picking up the folder he kept on me. On the way home, I started to have doubts. Maybe he really had just meant to be provocative. Was my reaction the one he had sought to provoke, after all? It's hard to know. And after all, he had been a fantastic therapist for my husband and, up until this point, for me. Wasn't that worth something? Regardless, my therapy with him was doomed, of course. The power structures were all out of whack, and I needed a guide, not someone to boss around. During the sessions that followed, yes, I did go back. I wanted to return to my childhood, my anxiety, my insomnia. He wanted to talk about our issues, everything the poem had stirred up. I would try to bring up some recurring dream, and he would steer the conversation back to how I had picked up my folder and rummaged through it, the way I had wanted to switch seats, all those power moves I had made, claiming that we were finally getting at something interesting. The problem was, those things interested him, not me. When I started having what seemed like therapy sessions with my husband about my strained relationship with my therapist, I knew it was time to quit. And I did it, just as my friend suggested, over the phone, by leaving a voicemail message, which was, in retrospect, cheap and cowardly, and probably showed how little progress I had made. But it didn't end there. In response, he wrote me a long letter, which included some heavy lifting about my relationship with my father, and he told me that my treatment of male characters in my novels deserved a deeper look into my issues with men. He wanted me to come back to address those issues. I wrote a one-page letter explaining why that wouldn't happen. And, annoyed by his literary critique, I ended the letter this way. As for the men in my books and in life, I call them the way I see them. Now, looking back at his letter and the connections he drew between my writing and my life, I think he offered the most in-depth analysis I have encountered and may ever come across. Whatever the case, in my sign-off, I told him not to contact me in any way. He hasn't. The strange thing is that my husband and I miss him. The angry letter he had Dave write as an assignment eventually became a calmer, more substantial letter that my husband did give to his mother, leading to a watershed moment in their relationship. And I still wonder if my anxiety and insomnia are issues he could decipher. Sometimes my husband or I will say something about how we feel or what we think we might be feeling, and we look at each other and ask, "Is that interesting?" And neither of us will know the answer.
That's Isabelle Huppert reading Juliana Baggett's essay, "Playing Role Reversal with My Therapist." We'll catch up with Juliana after the break.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
It's been almost 11 years since Juliana Baggett's essay was published, and she says that since then, she's come to think about the experience differently.
When someone does blur the lines and the boundaries for you, a lot of times I think our culture talks a lot about the feeling of being a victim in that situation. And I'm saying, hey, you know, you can have a lot of different emotions. You can have a lot of different reactions. And I don't feel bad for my very strange reaction of glee, you know, and, you know, being like, oh, I caught you. You're doing something clearly wrong, which in a weird way makes me clearly right. I like being right. I think that it's okay to have lots of different reactions to that. And if you gain a little power in that situation, that's okay. It's strange, but that's okay. And you can use that, maybe.
Juliana says the interaction didn't turn her off from therapy, and she's still interested in the way that your relationship with your therapist relates to your relationship with your partner.
There's so many times now in our contemporary society where you have two people who are supposed to have this incredibly intimate relationship, and that both of those people might very well likely have therapists with whom they're supposed to also have that intimate relationship where they're vulnerable. And so does that therapist relationship detract from the intimacy of the original couple's relationship and how we should rely on each other? Of course, that gets to be too much. I mean, Dave and I have both lived and had traumas and had things happen, and we don't have the skill set necessarily to always help each other in the way we need to. But in my definition of a relationship, the outside world is hard, and marriage itself should be kind of a sanctuary and a place where you can be vulnerable and have those intimate conversations. So I think that Dave and I, we save each other again and again and again in a way that no therapist could.
Juliana does not know if her therapist has read this piece. Since her response to his letter, they haven't been in contact.
That said, it was one of the most interesting experiences of my life to have a therapist who really knew my work. He felt he could read it probably too well, and that was his cockiness. Yeah, it was fascinating, and I still wonder sometimes, what would he think of this or what would he think of that? But I can guess at that, you know what I mean? And that's an interesting conversation for me and my husband to have, because that's really the person who I want to be intimate with and having those kinds of conversations with.
That's Juliana Baggett. She's the author of more than 20 books and lives in Delaware with her husband and four children. We've got more after the break.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
Here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for The New York Times.
What I really love about the dynamic that Juliana is wrestling with in this essay is how riddled with uncertainty the whole situation is, how therapy, just by its nature, you know, leaves you in the spot where you don't quite know how to feel about what's appropriate and what's inappropriate and what's useful and what's not and what is maybe an intentional strategy, but makes you feel sort of violated in a way. And she steps through that sort of field of ambiguity and just makes one sort of funny and clever observation after another. Instead of dismissing things as being wrong or embracing them as being right, she's just curious about it.
Next week, Zoe Saldana.
Mom took Joan's hand and held it tightly. "This is me getting old," she said. It is neither easy nor pleasant. But if I can get through this, so can you. Please know that I love you. Embrace yourself, because this is who I am now.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert and Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Special thanks to Samantha Hennig, Anya Stremian, and Mia Lee at The New York Times. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Additional music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.